I'm Jill Abram, I'm the event manager for this wonderful event, which is to launch Heath by Penelope Shuttle and John Greening, and published by Nine Arches. So I've welcomed you to the festival, and I would like to thank the Arts Council for their sponsorship of the festival and Jo Kingham for her sponsorship of this event. I'm going to introduce Jane Kermaine, the publisher behind Nine Arches, who's going to introduce the poets. Nine Arches has been going since 2008. It started with two pamphlets, and now by the end of the year we'll have 60 books. They also publish a magazine called Under the Radar, and issue 17 of that is just sitting waiting to be sent out. And I do like to brag, so I will tell you that the very first poem in it. So I hope you've all subscribed or buy a copy. Other poets you might have seen at the festival, published by Nine Arches, are Isabel Dixon, the South African poet who was here early in the week, and until recently a trustee of the festival, Jo Bell, who you might have seen read from her Nine Arches book Kith last year. And she was also involved with the 52 Project, and Jane published two books associated with that, which were the anthology of poems from the project and the prompt book, and that had the publication number 52 by coincidence, but I call it serendipity. Tonight's book is number 57, and so now to introduce it, I would like to welcome a woman who is little known as a poet in her own right, but believe me, she's a fine poet, and the publisher behind Nine Arches, Jane Kermaine.
Thank you very much, and good evening, Ledbury. What a wonderful festival, and what a delight to be here. Thank you for joining us this evening. On January the 1st, 1946, an aeroplane called Starlight took off for a 35-hour flight to Buenos Aires. This was the first scheduled flight from Heathrow Airport. And here begins our story. In 2006, on the 70th anniversary of Heathrow and that first passenger flight, we're launching Heath. Heath as a book, or rather a constellation of poems, an exchange as creative departures and arrivals between two poets, John Greening and Penelope Shuttle. The book first landed in my inbox in April 2015. On reading, I found a simply incredible poem sequence, alive with strange weathers and careful magic. From February 2014, our two poets had embarked on a process of sharing poems by email, prompted by a discovery that each had grown up either side of Hounslow Heath and underneath the flight path of Heathrow. As John has noted to me, part of the delight and energy in these poems is located in their unexpected and unpremeditated way in which they took flight, resulting, by the end of July 2014, in almost 200 pages of poems that each had written in response to each other's poem, creating this incredible chain series of poems which spoke to each other, which sung, and between poems that cover the urban, the natural, wolves, highwaymen, vinyl factories, spells, and so much more. There's a share of apparitions too, and many encounters upon the heath. And the heath itself, of course, which sings its own wild, rich song of furze and bramble, and provides innumerable diversions along the way. Wrong turns, lost paths. How could I resist such a truly enchanting book, such a wild and enchanting series of poems, so eloquent? It was spellbinding, and I simply had to publish it. This means I've also had the absolute delight and privilege to have worked with John and Penelope, and it has been such a pleasure to work with them both. It's work, incidentally, that began last summer at last Ledbury Festival in 2015, when Penny and myself first started work on some of the poems, and then subsequently met at South Bank slightly later in the autumn with both Penny and John to do further work on the poems together. So here today, I am absolutely delighted to return to Ledbury and to launch Heath on its maiden flight. I invite you all as our fellow travellers to join us and to welcome Penelope Shuttle and John Greening to read from Heath. Thank you.
Thank you, Jade. That's a wonderful distillation of the Heath. I'd like to thank Chloe and the festival for inviting us to launch Heath here, and I'd like to thank Joe Kingham for supporting this event. The very, very beginnings of Heath were a discussion John and I had after he'd come to Falmouth and given a poetry reading, and he'd included in his reading his poem Heath Row from his book To the War Dead. And in that poem, he lifts up Heath Row like a stone to see what's underneath it. And what is underneath it? There's a Roman camp, there's a Druid temple, there are Vikings, there are highwaymen, there are the things that Jane said. And Heathrow Airport was literally dropped as if from the sky onto the old Hounslow Heath, one of the most dangerous places in England in the 17th century, where highwaymen roamed. So we had a long discussion, and it drew into it the fact that we were both born within earshot, very much so, of the airport. I at Staines, John at Hounslow. So the presence of both the airport and the Heath was a very big part of our growing up. And as we shared more and more memories, we thought we should write some poems about this, because I haven't ever really written about Staines, because when I was a young poet, Staines, airport, boring, don't want to write about that. But from a perspective of years and geographical distance and renewing our memories, we found we wanted to write about it. We thought some poems for a magazine, a sequence for a magazine. These poems came along. Oh, poems for a pamphlet. And so it went on. And when we got to 150 poems, pages, we thought this is definitely a book. And we're very happy to begin to read it here. We're going to begin with one of the brief invocatory fragments that thread their way through the book, Ghostings of the Heath. And then we're going to read the first six poems in the book straight through. So
it's rather like, and this comes up in one of the first poems, rather like Banquo and Macbeth setting out across their heath. You'll hear references to that. Perhaps we should say something about the Bell Inn, which is referred to a few times as well. The Bell Inn is where travellers used to have a drink before they set out on this dangerous stretch of land. And Penny and I met there for a while as well to have a drink. So the Bell Inn, they used to hang gibbets, put gibbets there with miscreants on to warn people they should behave better. So here we go.
Heath slips a wordless word into your pocket, crosses your palm with rain, gives you back your forgotten name.
Removes the finger posts, the milestones, in preparation. This is a dry, dangerous place away from the river. From the everyday, its safe demands. The last mill's wave, a hovel's distant wink, with a drink to change. Their talk rattling like chainmail, a pair go riding under the gibbet and into the dark, all battles behind them. The Bath Road or the Staines Road. Neither can avoid that bleak exposure where the enlisted will be drilled, where invading forces muster. Without one church spire to contradict the horizontal. A zone you enter to find yourself heading towards yourself, free of the march, the taut spring, into a timelessness, a fencelessness. Our famous heath. Its enormous absence of anything but lizard, buzzard, kite and mouse. No coppice or hedge or field, but an unenclosed pack of wild tracks, firs, bog, then a single roding night bird, and a final call for the wolf of Perry Oaks. You are far from the Bell Inn, the comforting tree song of the high streets untongued as they swing, grow greener by the month, or feel the warp of a rib cage shot by a fresh southwesterly.
Departures, arrivals. Before bed, I lean out the window into cold air or mild, a rainy night, or dry as dust moonlight, to watch the stacked planes twinkle by. I could reach out my hand to touch them, it seems, as they firefly about above trees and streets, where the night makes its peace or not, above old desire paths of footpath, footpad and outlaw, long licked off history's dark plate. What was once the heath, that great track of taplow gravel, little rivers, eel weirs and warrens, is a built geometry of light now. Towers, terminals, runways, fences, bleached by the grid's flawless scrutiny. No dark corners at Heathrow, except in the hearts of travellers, traipsing along the weary travelators who work thankless night and day. I love to watch the starry planes flicker in from corners of the globe or rising to find their place in the sky. I love the faint jet roar behind cloud. Heathrow's gruff, familiar lullaby for the turning earth.
Stop. Listen. Nothing but the invisible drone in the air of Bombus terrestris taking off from the heather, at work while others sing. But the songsters have all gone away for August, leaving the cricket, the clockworking alarm of game birds, and a stone chat to chip at time. I am humming through familiar numbers, all beginning on G, descending to a ground bass. Broom, bracken, broom, tormentil. It's good to step into the open, unknown, not wearing a mask, not needing to, alive in the sun and with no intention of holding anyone up. The mail is allowed to pass by, its horses panting. We came looking for quiet. If I had taken a deer and seen my eyes put out by the conqueror's men to pay for it, all I would know now is the nightjar and some white noise from a pair of doves who are longing for one single tree. Uneasily, one senses something overhead that hovers, an envoy from the powers that be, spying naturally on low life here without license. Poaching? Hunting, Your Honour, a quiet day or days. A dangerous cloud, the colour of money, scuds a missile thrush towards us, followed by flashes, thousands of them, from some peninsula of connectedness and constantly crashing waves, crying their fame and mewing crazed ideas, a thousand drafts of the unlistening future.
Bombus terrestris, you say. She might or must be a namesake queen, for the first bumblebees to be seen in the spring are the queens, and with that white abdomen, she's a queen, searching out any abandoned mouse or vole burrow where she'll nest sub rosa, store her honey pot and her pollen larder, to see her through hazards of the heath. And so it goes through millions of summers, rain and shine, come cold autumn weather, all but the young queens die.
It is night now on the great track, among the weirs and warrens. Not even the moon has control here. Guidance must be what the eye can snatch from obscurity, catching either huge iron wheels that will plunge you to bath by dray, by draft, gouging the mind to clods and furrows, conquest, or the quiet, light hooves of whatever was hired in Hounslow, clever enough to nip across country at the first click of flintlock, muzzled flash in the pan, and hellfire curse. Of course, for those who are not afraid of witches, there is this weird crossing to be made on foot. If we are lucky, avoiding the upturned wagon, its cold, silent passengers, that fleet steed from the bell stuck fast and sinking. And there is always the ghost of the long-lost, long-straight Roman road, its agger obscured by heaps of baggage, pannage, sewage, droppings on new-age sheep tracks that trace a zodiac or a maze round a distant tor. In truth, the heath can only be negotiated with closed eyes, by letting what's out there start up its ghostly scan, by enduring interrogations from ice and filth and law, by passing through the gate of clay or the gate of gravel.
I hear each clunky sand grain
as it falls through
the heath's old hourglass. The king's apothecary, etc. The king's apothecary was paid well to supply perfumes to Stanwell Manor when that fine place belonged to the crown. Thomas Allsop had no fear of witches and their ilk. He knew, it was his business to know, that sense of smell is stronger and older than witches, and he who devises and manufactures perfumes will always have the old reptilian brain on side. Do your worst, witches, for this master of the king's perfumes will cross your hag-ridden heath wrapped in the protective benison of bergamot, gilliflower, geranium, violets, honeysuckle, oak and walnut leaves, and whatever else he plucks from his laboratory herbarium and distills in the great glass retorts, along with snails and cloves, cinnamon and citronade, boxes of perfumes for burning, perfumes to be suffused in water, destined for Henry, the royal person. Everyone knows sweet smells signify goodness and power. They create an aura around the king and his circle, for, of course, there's some fragrant trickle-down for his courtiers, his mistresses, his dog handlers and his ostlers, the gentlemen of his bedchamber. Perfumes to unstench the rank, well-born rooms of the English Renaissance, to turn fever's cheek, to slake our longing for the odour of perpetual rose, a rose which has its old home and haunt in Stanmore, where the green Lammas lands run their quiet course towards the dark fell and ditches of the heath, and where, alas, 300 years later the apothecary is long gone, and the unperfumed 19th century populace has but lone lines of stagecoaches passing through the turnpikes for nightly show. The unscrupulous sink to their mounts and ride to Mad Hill, where they lie in wait to seize any chance that comes their way, while those who snore in the toll house won't wake, won't look from window or door to where night hides and gives its blessing to the worst.
That's how the book opens. So the airport dominated everything, both our childhoods, but the heath is underneath it, and one somehow was aware of that. I used to hear, because my bedroom was under the main flight path to Heathrow Airport, but also used to hear at night strange sounds of engines being tested, which was like some kind of wild animal in the distance. Perhaps that was the heath speaking. So a couple of poems now, one by me, one by Penny, about planes and the airport. So this refers to the noise. Incidentally, our house we lived, some years after we left it, I heard that the roof had been whipped off the house by a passing plane, the vortex, not when we were in it. So this is number 7. In over the blackthorn hoard, a dragon's primitive piston breath. In over the hawthorn blossom, a skirling and a whirling Clan Douglas. In over honeysuckle vines, turbo bred, the power of viscounts. In over a wild rose, the stage-whispering giant Britannia. In over brambles, a tail-end gasp, it stumbles on, the vanguard. Out over sloes, as quick as its shocking, kick-shattering comet. Out over blackberries, sevens keep rolling, Seattle to jumbo to dream. Out over whores, to rear-end the suburbs it roars, I am trident. Out over hips, its sneering lips and raised nose boom, Concord. Out over old man's beard, Europe hangs by a wire.
Building an airport. To build an airport, you need bad weather dreams, blue sky thinking, a politico or two in your pocket. To build the airport, you need work crews of bulky young men, specially selected from Corinthian villages. To build an airport, you need 117 eggshells, a snowplough, a thirst stone, some slaves, the words of a charm, and the vicar of Harmonsworth. To build the airport, you need a fistful of dollars, a joke about Barcelona, wartime legislation, some dry oak leaves, some horses, a drinking trough, and 16 daughters. To build an airport, you need a thick skin, a tongue of fire, a hamlet no one important cares about, plus someone interested in sewage and the Star of David. To build the airport, you need a shopping list, a wish list, a hit list, a Heath, Starlight and Buenos Aires, and the diversion of two historic rivers, don't you? Don't you?
So we found ourselves sharing subjects, and one of these was the yew tree at Harlington Church. Harlington's very near the airport, constantly under threat. It's quite a famous yew, and been topiarised, if that's a verb, several times into different creatures. And there's a famous Norman porch in the church with cats in it, which I refer to in my poem, which is a shape poem. You can't act out a shape poem on stage, sadly. And then Penny does a similar yew poem. So we're going to read those two poems. And this is a famous yew tree near here, Much Markle, isn't it? Yew. At Harlington. Oblivious to the date, but not to shape. Having been all things in a thousand years, revising, regenerating, ramifying, before this pudding stone was ever dreamt of. Do I go inside and sit beneath you in contemplation of your taxing questions? The church has no answer, except for its bell towers, three stories, castellated with a turret, a cupola, golden ball, and weather vane. You are the poison, it tolls. You, it tolls. We are the antidote. But the man in clerical scrubs patrolling the parish wards gives place to another in green overalls with shears who has had a vision. The dead, who have slept through an eternity of sermons, are thinking of sitting up to watch this. What will it be resurrected as this time? Swan or fawn or horse or peacock? The cats in the doorway have their tongues out. The tree that was the focus of a festival, object of worship, the tree has become a laughing stock, a passing curiosity around which more pressing roots direct us to go searching for a living.
And before Harlington was Harlington, it was Arlington. And this is a poem about that yew, but I also do reference the Much Markle yew, which I have sat in, haven't we, Pat? Graham. The mirror of amusement. In the mirror of amusement, you will sometimes perceive the ancient yew of Arlington spending long nights in green prayer and long days in contemplation of the runways, terminals, and travel lodges that have their churchings, weathers, and perimeters all around, encroaching upon the copperplate soul of the ancient tree, once so wildly topiarised, but now left to its own fate. And for my part, I have known other ancient yews, and climbed within the bower of this one, and clung to the fortitude of that, as with its old green companions it circled a church on the Welsh border, and gave sanctuary to the bees, who fetched hither and yon among the gnarled and fanciful appurtenances of bough and millennial trunk. And in the mirror of amusement, I have seen Arlington fade from the map and Heathrow rise in its place, and the prudence of our ancestor yew planters be forgotten, and all their instructions for ways of living go the same way under flight path and conning tower and the unending legend of airport expansion into areas where your Oyster card may not be valid. So it just seemed from those two poems that we are you know, picking one another's brains. We're sharing researches. The two U poems. You might have noticed we both had a bumblebee poem, John's poem, Bombastis Terrestris. I picked up on that. And we're going to go on to show how this call and response works as we went on sort of exchanging forms as well, the couplet form, the shape poem. And the wonderful thing now is that you could just email these poems back and forth. So one poem would come into my inbox or yours, and another one. I sent a poem that was a list poem that's called As If, and it's about as if the airport had never been built, just sent to John. And then, like a Wimbledon volley, about almost by the next half hour, back came John's poem, If As. And so we are going to read... first of all, mine, As If, and then John's If As, and a couple more that show how, as you collaborate, you kind of, in a way, become one person, don't
That's right.
you?
Yeah.
As if the earth swallowed it up, as if the river broke free. As if a warrior in coat of mail held all the cards, and as if the little Ely ditches ran riot. As if the inns flung their signs, four sheets to the wind, as if vole and pipistrel failed in their duty. As if even the moon got lost out there, where only man is vile. As if watermint and sheep sorrel knew too much and not enough. As if stonechat and siskin faced no danger from man, and an iron-studded dragon sailed under earth forever. As if no one leapt the weir to one future and not t'other. As if no beacons were lit. As if no fence, no gate, and all its ghosts never seen. As if the yew'd never aged or been. As if the oak never leafed. As if the night was just the stars, as if the relic species kept their own counsel, as if the cart tracks wobbled home forever, as if the earth swallowed it up, as if the speech thorn choked on its own prayer, as if the dew ponds stopped caring, as if the paths got tangled up forever, as if the airport had never been built.
If, as you tap your reg in the car parking machine, the number that appears ends in BC, if, as you take the tube from Hatton Cross to the terminal, others in your cage have obvious tattoos, if, as you look at the departures board, you realise your flight from the Paleolithic has been delayed, if, as you book into the Temporal Inn and give your name, the name that comes out is Hundy's, if, as you lay your head onto memory foam, the pillow turns to an anvil, your dream to flint. If, as you reach in the bathroom for the shower gel, you find instead a small green amulet of a boar. If, as your taxi arrives, it has a skull swinging at the glass and a driver singing Circle of Life. If, as you're taken through the underpass, you think you see mistletoe in a canopy of oak boughs. If, as the uniforms look you over, they find in your baggage a sickle, a celt, and a bronze gouge. If, as a last something for the journey, they press a cold shoulder of mutton into your hand. If, as the procession slithers through a silver barrier towards a grove of tinted glass. If, as a clearing opens in the old heath and the plain facts dawn on you, especially... if, as they greet you, the stewards are in white or bearded and say, welcome to Roon Air, then ask if fares from Hounslow Heath are perhaps refundable.
What the Heath knew. What the Heath knew, it kept secret. What the Heath thought chilled the heart. The Heath drove a hard bargain. How the Heath slept was a dark matter, and how the Heath practised all its skills was a wonder to the breath-held, watching world. the heath wanted to be unusual, like the first ever drawing of the moon seen by Mr. Harriot through a 1609 telescope. Dream on, Heath.
At the sign of the bush, a quiet corner, snug, and one sip of Watkins ale is what the Heath desired. Butio, Butio calling, Milvus falling, Hellkite over its secret heaven is what the Heath feared. A footsole, 100 footsoles, rope, leather, rubber, plastic, plastic, plastic is what the Heath touched. Silence and solitude, starlight and worm cast, a clear horizon and a hollow way, green lanes are what the Heath wanted. Lizard scales, airborne arpeggios, sustained brazen blasts, kettle drum, snare drum are what the Heath practiced. Fitfully, interruptedly, through alarums, excursions and gremlins of delay, milkman to action man is how the Heath slept. That one and nil make the future, that after this hanging, nowhere for pardoning, is what the Heath thought.
What the Heath touched. What the Heath touched was always changing. What the Heath feared was nothing but the silence following its every move, because what the Heath desired was not the quiet after the storm, but the storm itself. If the Heath was a hand, it was a fist. Look at those bare knuckles. Since the day it was born, the Heath has never held or kept its peace.
This poem is a memory of school, where lessons were constantly interrupted by planes going over, as was everything. The plane carrying geography passes over towards Heathrow and it says, "The map I'm following is signed Speed." The plane carrying history passes over towards Heathrow and it says, "Here is the paper. I folded it into a dart." The plane carrying chemistry passes over towards Heathrow and it says, "My cauldron, my crucible, my melting pot." The plane carrying physics passes over towards Heathrow and it says, "Boom," but only after it has vanished. The plane carrying biology passes over towards Heathrow and it says, "Fly pandemic, jet lag, DVT." The plane carrying maths passes over towards Heathrow and it says, "Given that you have real roots, go figure." The plane carrying art passes over towards Heathrow and it says, as it brushes Greenbelt with its shadow, "The plane carrying design passes over towards Heathrow and has a better idea." The plane carrying religious studies passes over towards Heathrow, spire, minaret, looking for crop circles. The plane carrying French, Spanish, German, Chinese, Gujarati passes over towards Heathrow and says nothing. The plane carrying English passes over towards Heathrow and keeps on going.
The plane carrying English passes over Heathrow and keeps on going. We think of the English language as a language that has become enriched and has always been welcoming to migrant words, words from other languages. In the borough of Hounslow, 186 languages are spoken, and hopefully poetry is being written in those 160 languages. But poetry can be perilous, and at this moment I'd like to focus on the partnership at the moment between the Ledbury Poetry Festival and PEN, which is Poetry in Protest, which is focusing on poets who are imprisoned and persecuted for their beliefs. And so I would like to read a poem by the Chinese poet Louis Zha. She's been under extrajudicial house arrest in Beijing since her husband, the poet Liu Xiaobo, was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. He was immediately imprisoned and she was immediately put under house arrest. So she is unable to have the internet. She is cut off from all communications. Also, she has a heart condition but is very wary of consulting doctors because she believes that the Chinese authorities will use this to put her in a mental institution. And so I would like to read. I would say do please look at the Penn website to find out more about Louise Ja and other poets who are imprisoned for their poetry and their beliefs and do think about joining Penn to support them. This poem is Transformed Creatures by Liu Jia, translated by Ming Dai. You have a strange pet. One eye is a cat's, the other a sheep's. Yet it won't socialise with felines, will attack any flock. On moonlit nights, it wanders on the roof. When you're alone, it will lie in your lap, preoccupied, slowly studying you until, on its face, a challenge. I'd like to take the wolfishness of that poem and carry it forward to the wolf that quite haunts Heath. The last wolf in England is believed to have been killed at Perry Oaks, which is within the Heathrow perimeter now. At a much later date, after the wolf was killed, it became a sewage works. So I really wanted to inhabit this wolf for a little bit. You can see, there he is. Can you see him? Mm. Wolf of Perry Oaks. Blindfold goes he across the wild and heath, the wolf of Perry Oaks. Only by the reek of the hour does he know if night sinks or day blinks o'er wild track and bog as he dodges the Swan Inn, the Five Bells. Paw by paw and sniff by sniff goes he, wolf antiquary, last wolf of all the southern wolves, wolfy of the heath, playing blind wolf's buff, or wolf-bane waltzing and whittling as he measures his territory by day and by night, by fear and by fright. And in the dark where wolf goes, there's a scent that leads to the heath's front door, but Wolfie never goes there. No, he goes the long way round. In the dark where Greycoat goes, there's a tree where the spirits meet. When Ulfra goes by, he's quiet and polite and never fails to be loved. When Ulfra goes by, in the dark, there's a cold, swift stream running and Ulf leaps over. The wolf leaps over, never looking back at the heath's dark door where Ulfra never knocks. Did you know the Louvre was built originally as a wolf kennel?
Quite a lot of music in the book. So it was Hounslow was the place I first learned to love music. And I worked at EMI, which is on Hounslow Heath. Used to cycle across the heath to it. If you ever go into Paddington on the train, you see his master's voice up there at the side of the old factory. That's where I worked on the returning LPs as a student. And this is a poem about that. Under the new extension to the record factory at Hayes, the one I used to cycle to at 33 RPM, or 78 if I was late, dealing with returns, unwrapping the layers and layers, weird enclosures, hieroglyphic complaints, clocking off, clocking on again, the days of counting the hours, only to place them unceremonially in a skip, so they could be taken through the sacred gates of EMI, and somewhere in a field to the west, whose location is yet to be established, quietly buried. They found a statue from the 2nd century BC, Egyptian, of a priest carrying the shrine of a god. As if he had picked out a boxed set of the complete recordings of every Mass for the Dead ever written from Beethoven to Berlioz to Britain. Now here he is, off to the checkout, waiting, waiting, long after long players, long after the latest Adams MP3, still waiting to pay, when a small dog nips across to him and says, "Drop what you're doing. There's an important message from the master." Well, that reference to Egypt is a kind of link to the English pen poet that I'm representing here today. That's the Egyptian Omar Hasek, who was imprisoned for protesting without permission and has a travel ban. He won an award recently and wasn't allowed to go and receive it. Dreadful conditions, he survived. So this is an extract from a long poem. He tends to write long poems. A long poem called Apple. It seems to tie in with the lots of orchards in the Hausa Heath, and market gardens seem to tie in with that as well. It's a lovely extract. It's translated by Elizabeth Jacquet. He was given an apple in prison. Apple, once in a garden. Apple, once in a garden. An apple, this apple, now here in my hands, flees from me in the dark night of the cell, shuts in my hand its shutters, senses my hunger. Apple, I told it, there's nothing to fear. Sleep beside me while I lie awake, searching in the darkness for a voice to drink and sing how I want, for the warden knows not who I am. Apple, I told it, place your hand in mine. Don't walk alone through the night that rests from you, your lovely red. What would your mother say, Apple, bleeding, bare in the drunken rain?
And I think we'd like to conclude with a set of... Do you think we have time for six poems, three each? Mm. And there might be a little time at the end for questions. So this is a set of really diversely themed poems now, taken from throughout the book. So my three will include one on highwaymen, one about a bus, and one about something called a scorn pole. Does anyone know what a scorn pole is? It's a Scandinavian cursing pole, and it's like a totem pole, and in the old days it had would have a severed head on it, or a severed horse's head. And if you opened your front door and you found a scorn pole out in your garden, things were not going to be going well for you that day.
And my poem, it starts off with a memory of my uncle, who was an insurance salesman. He used to go around the heath on his moped, a sort of kind of modern-day highwayman, I suppose. It sort of ties in with pennies. Then there's a sort of oblique celebration of the sort of multiracial modern heath, starting off in a cafe. And then finally, an urban myth, a ghost story associated with Heathrow, quite a famous ghost story, actually. You find it on the internet, anyway. So...
This is called Beyond the Boundstone, and the boundstone are the boundaries of a parish where lawful civic life goes on. And beyond the boundstone is where outlaws are found. And this is about two highwaymen, Dick Turpin and Claude Duval, who was a French highwayman who moved to Hounslow Heath because it was a good career move. The pickings were a great deal richer. Beyond the boundstone... Turpin and Duval know not a double act at all, straight man and clown, and not a magic act, yet they vanish into and out of thin air. Duval and Turpin, not a firm of lawyers, undertakers, accountants, etc. And yet they're men of business, swift nicks, moonlight jacks, star turns on the road, a pleasure doing business with you, sir, monsieur, an honour to be robbed blind by your honour on Hounslow Heath. It rhymes with teeth. And hard to tell where one of you begins and the other ends. High up on your fine steed, monsieur, your sturdy fleet-foot mare, Master Turpin, springing out of the mists on Hounslow Heath as if from a far-flung time wherein the memory of man existeth not, manifest from the nowheres of the Staines Road or via Trinobantes, brandishing an impeccable blade, beating the bounds of the air, uttering that lilting command, stand, and the coach veers as the horses slam to a halt and the alarm snake bites the passengers awake and the coachman spits at the robber's spurred boot as the jangle of coins changes hands and the pocket watch of chiming gold and the snuff box of sneezy silver. And off they gallop, Turpin and Duval, brisk as a coinage town. Bon chance, messieurs, and bravo, sirs, to your entente cordiale of the road.
Lightly propelled on a moped, he goes from door to door to ask if you would like life insurance. They do not answer. The occupants are all long gone. This latter-day highwayman loves music. And as he demands his premium, he is hearing hidden pastorals from Heston and Isleworth. The suburban tables go on turning now he has ridden into the west. Is there anybody there? A whirling witch's Sabbath? A moping viola? A donkey's bray? But when he rode to ford the Brent, his pistols were the latest loudspeakers, his dagger an elliptical diamond. The sun goes up across the heath like the radiant yellow label Zarathustra, then sinks, a silver disc, a single ray, to a mass of life.
I was on a bus in Staines and I saw a slogan on the bus and it said, serving the people of West London. And so I thought I would take that into this poem. Serving the people of West London. Like today's fine bus, bearing this wise slogan, merely one of a fleet of fine, hard-working buses, I too wish to serve the people of West London, for am I not West London born and bred? Did my grandfather Lipscomb not spring from fair Stanwell, and grandfather Frederick from slightly fairer Egham? Let me serve the people, let them demand an elegy or a sestina, a villanelle or a handful of quatrains in praise of West London, even a coronet of sonnets. I'll supply it. Be in touch, people of West London, people of Uxbridge and Feltham, of Southall, Boston Manor, Brentford and Hillingdon, even leafy Chiswick, with your wide variety of quality food outlets. When hunger for poetry surges through you, people of Richmond and Twickenham and dear dingy Hounslow, when that hunger surges into your western hearts, Heston and Heathrow, Norbiton and New Malden, I'll dish it up. Delicious, nourishing stanzas on underpraised West London, with its lovely orchards and forests, much diminished, but hanging in there in beautiful back gardens and unmockable little parks, and in living proof of a good place, say, none better than the moor of Staines, where proud Highland cattle still graze. My desire to serve the people of West London is what gets me out of bed every morning, propelling me breakfastless to my screen to praise and extol the beauty and truth only to be found in West London. And when I collapse into bed at word-drained midnight, I fall asleep, confident that the people of West London will never go in want of poetry. I will serve them.
Eat is at the centre of it. Eat, full stop. A cafe. Wait there. We might even be able to meet for a moment. You and I, from different races, different classes. It is a level playing field, so long as you belong to the school that owns a heavy roller. And it is cricket, never football. At either end of our heath are rugby posts. Look. You can try, or you could convert, or you can do both. No choice, however, as to the game or your position. And of course you're in the B or C or D team. At the heart of our heath is A. It has designs on you to test your discernment, to measure you. Shake hands and feel the heat. There's hate inside. It's a game of survival played out with a child's swollen stomach from Bangladesh to Southall, kicking ashes, always nearly making a heart. And should we meet with others travelling up to the viewing gallery for tea, we can discuss what we ate.
Scornpole on the heath. The scornpole appears overnight, from a world where footfall never goes, where the coffee shops never open or close, where the streets fall to their knees at the turn of the hour, and a cloud's funeral plays on the news, and no one forgets to vote, but nothing changes. The scorn pole fans its own flames, cools its own porridge, has a second income, clambers up into the crow's nest sky, is both visible and invisible from all sides of the heath, like a pirate ship hidden in the shallows, carrying a crew of 50 cutthroats, Captain Scrimshaw, and no treasure map to drive away the elves. The scorn pole nods its horse skull head, nods the heath astray. But as for a curse, who cares about that? Not this folkish heath, that's for sure. Do your worst, runish scorn pole.
A man has been spotted standing on the runway, looking anxiously as if he were waiting for the tube, although the tube will not be leaving Hounslow for years. Flights have been grounded, security is on its way, but he's unmoved, intent on looking, looking for his briefcase, this best-dressed scarecrow, unscared by lasers, acoustic dispersal, or high-vis waving. Clear off! People are wanting their holidays. There are urgent supplies for Africa. VIPs in the lounge, animals in the hold. Where is that missing combination lock, whose number he knows so well he can repeat it, repeat it? A honking red and orange V comes smearing by to flash and grab the seam and hisses right through him. Of course he was never there. An urban myth drifting through our online departure lounge, materialised from something in 1948, a crash or some other rubbish from the 70s. But I knew that man. He walked out onto the heath one morning in his grey flared suit, his sandwiches safe in their Tupperware, and disappeared into the rising sun. Took off, was gone, his paunch, moustache and sideburns, his cigarette smoke, and in his briefcase, what? Not, one imagines, a report on the latest findings regarding the percentage of people in terminal buildings who might be ghosts.
The lights go up for the opening lines, but no one enters.
Just an unscheduled rasp of song.
Yes, we're happy to
answer
questions. We've left that little space on purpose.
Yeah. Also happy to sign books later.
Any questions from anybody?
Pat?
Yes, have you yet thought that that might make a very interesting radio programme?
We have, yes. We haven't really pursued it enough, really.
For the call.
Bit of a pipe dream, so perhaps we should try and push that a bit more.
Yes, we're
slightly in negotiations with the Verbs, so there might be a piece there, a segment, but that's still all on the drawing board. Yes, it would. It hopefully would take off there. Yes.
It's probably better than that than a TV programme. It's best imagined rather than seen. How's it?
Yes.
I was going to ask how long it took you to put this together, from beginning to having a kind of finished manuscript.
It's February to July.
February to July. It was a lot faster for me because I'm someone who puts poems away for months, goes back to them, rewrites them, reorders the whole running order, puts it away for a year, goes back to it. does it again. But I think one of the things about collaboration is that it's quite precipitate. Mm. I was saying that about the Wimbledon volley, you know, with poems going at the height of it. Poems were going to and fro and to and fro. And some of the time I had a little retreat in France, and when one post, John got five poems, because I'd slightly fallen behind.
And then it went the other way.
We would catch up.
And then there were a few last poems in September, weren't there? But basically it was done in that time.
Yes. So
White Heat.
It was. It was a bit of a possession, really.
But it was, as said in the introduction, as Jane said, it was unexpected, and I often think that's those are the best conditions for poetry, something you didn't expect you were going to be writing. Yeah. It's surprising you as you're writing it.
Yeah, if someone had come along and said, OK, Penny and John, now you just go off and you write about Heathrow, and we'd say, oh, God. But as I think I mentioned earlier, we started out thinking of it really just as being a few poems that make lovely magazine.
That's right.
Feature, and then more poems. It was a pamphlet, and so on from there. And I think too, as poets, we all know that there's the thing between solitude you need for writing and kind of the loneliness when you've been on your own writing for a while. And so when you're in collaboration, you don't have sort of the lonely side of that. You have the response from your co-poet, and you have a sense of fellowship rather than when it tips over from solitude into loneliness.
I'm delighted to have done.
You know, it's when you shout down into the Grand Canyon, and not an echo comes back, but a voice on the other side of the Grand Canyon says, I'm here, and so communication goes forward. It's quite addictive, wasn't it? It was very hard to stop writing poems. We wrote so many poems that were afterthoughts and that got removed because, you know, you just think, oh, we're just going to carry on and to volume two, volume three, volume four. But then we came to our senses.
I certainly always wanted to do a collaboration like that. I much admired Sylvia Cantaris and Philip Gross's Air Mines of Mistilla years ago. And so collaboration is fascinating. Yes.
With this collaboration, did you find you in any way were influencing each other's style?
I think we did.
Some
of the poems are actually co-written, just two or three.
Yes, there's about four poems in there when we've just drafted and redrafted.
And we edited each other's work.
Exactly, there's a lot of working editorially on the poems.
My intended to be long-lined poems, and Ben is short-lined ones to begin with, that stayed for much of the book, actually, didn't it?
It did.
But tonally, I think that we sort of moved closer and closer to each other.
I think the sharing of research, you know, one of us would uncover a fact or an article and send it to the other one, and then further researches would be done. And I think that was a huge part of the collaboration, because it's a kind of subject when you could be quite Sherlock Holmes about it and find researching on there's a lot more about the wildlife on the heath. In fact, Hounslow Heath still exists as a small park, a site of special scientific interest. And when we'd finished the book, we went to Hounslow and strolled around.
Celebratory walk around Hounslow.
An hour and a half. Yeah. But it's kind of collaboration. It is, you know, now it would be rather hard to go back and remember who said move that comma and who said, oh, we'll change this title and things like that, because you're just right in the sort of furnace of the whole thing.
Which I think is quite a common experience of poets, isn't it? So you get in the zone and suddenly you move on to something else and it's from the past.
Yes. But
I dare say there have been many of us in this room who have spent hours at Heathrow, but I'm sure that none of them have been anywhere near as enjoyable as the hour we've just spent there together. And it's been great to see the enjoyment that the two of you have had working together. So thank you very much. But please join me in the traditional Ledbury way of thanking Nelke Shuttle and John Greening.